This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the Ohio area attorney, Jay Carson. Jay, hey. Welcome to the right-wing takeover of The Politics Guys.
Yeah, thanks, Trey. Good to be here. We can have all get in all kinds of trouble while Mike's gone this week.
Exactly. He can't keep us in check.
May be disappointed that, again, and this is something we'll talk about, is what is the right anymore?
It's everything. It's nothing. Yeah. It's... No, and that's a fair question. But now, never fear. I do want to say for those who are wondering, so this week, Jay and I are taking over the show in kind of a special edition of the rights being together. But next week, if that floats your boat.
Just so because there's some leftists, when we say taking over, some people, again, assume insurrection. Mike's fine.
that's right. The last time we did this, there was a possibility he was in the basement, right? Like we did that for a few weeks.
Yeah, he's just got the weekend off. So yeah, it's not
permanent.
It's not a
yeah. Well, it's gonna be a rotation of power. Next week, Mike and Ken are gonna come in and they're gonna give their very wrong left wing views, and they can get together about how the Supreme Court is corrupt and. Okay, so in all seriousness, yeah, so we got this week, you and myself, and next week we got Mike and Ken, and I hope, listeners, that you find our little bit of a switch up on what we do a lot of fun. And Jay, I'm looking forward to doing the show with you because we don't get to do that often, so.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I think maybe it's kind of apropos that we take over this particular week because, of course, the Democratic primary in New Hampshire didn't exist, right? Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't delegate any votes. And you know, we'll let Mike and Ken sort out whether they agree or disagree with Biden's push for that. But instead, I thought we would really focus on New Hampshire on the Republican side, because that's where delegates were coming and a lot of things were going on. And so for listeners, I'm assuming if you listen to the show, you've probably looked at some of this, but it's worth having a little bit of a recap. Donald Trump wins with 176,000 votes, which accounts for about 54.3% of the total and nets him 12 delegates. Meanwhile, Nikki Haley, the last remaining contender in the Republican primary against former President Donald Trump, received 140,096 votes, which accounts for 43.2%. And that delegate gets her about nine, not about, that gets her nine delegates. Now, I am a Haley fan. I don't know about you on that front, Jay, so I'll ask you that in just a second. But that was a disappointing outing, of course. Haley, when you take a look at those numbers, right, she's most effective with independents, but she loses 3/4 of Republicans. And that's just not a good sign, you know, in a primary season, right? And then although technically Nevada comes next, you know, it's a caucus. It's not going to get any delegates. And so really the next contest is her home state in South Carolina. But that's not until we finish out February. It is a ways in the future. So, Jay, we're in a weird position because when you look at the polling data, and I spent a lot of time taking a look at this, most voters in both parties, they don't want Trump or Biden. As a matter of fact, when you poll them nationally, this past week, CBS News found that Haley is up 8 points over Biden nationally and above Trump and well over the margin of error of 2%. While those two individuals, Trump and Biden, they're still polling in that poll in a neck and neck, in other words, inside the margin of error tie. So a statistical tie. And if you look at the details, you can see why. She pulls more voters with college degrees, more moderate Republicans, independents, women, and she even picks up some Democrats. So Of course, the other interesting thing about New Hampshire is the number of ballots clocked. If you add up the votes I was talking about there a second ago, that gets us to 300,000 cast ballots. That's the most for any New Hampshire presidential primary, even for a state known for pretty high turnout. So for a point of reference, right, there's only 1.3 million people who live in New Hampshire, and 300,000 of them showed up for a primary. So Ken, you know, again, I think Haley should continue to move forward if for no other reason than to protest this stupid model of just having a couple of states go early and then pretend that that's how this works, which is, if listeners might remember, that's what Obama did to Hillary, and it worked out pretty well for him. Although I don't think, unfortunately, that Nikki Haley is going to be an Obama. What's your take on some of that? And I'm just curious, too, you know, Republican to Republican. I was a Haley fan. Where were you?
So I am a Haley fan. Again, I take care on the show not to officially endorse candidates, because that's not my job, right? But I think I've been on record plenty of times saying, you know, Trump is an idiot. Nikki Haley represents more of the traditional Republican Party that I grew up with, and that is becoming a more and more apparently rare animal. So a couple of things on the how she did. On the one hand, you could look at the result and say, well, yeah, she got her clock cleaned, and that would be entirely true. Second, you could say she actually sort of overperformed. I think she did better than a lot of people thought, better than I thought she would. I thought she'd finish in the mid 30s. But then you go back to the point of, yes, but she absolutely got her clock cleaned, right?
But in terms of delegates, though, of course, like you say, it's 12-9, right? I mean, in terms of delegates, it's 12-9. It's not like she got cleaned in the sense, as you're noting, that, like, I mean, it's just a few delegates away.
Yeah, but it's more what do those numbers portend?
Yeah.
And I think there's a couple other things going on. You mentioned the high turnout. New Hampshire is a sort of semi-open primary, right, where you can essentially declare your affiliation, and you know, when you show up, and you just ask for whatever ballot. So included in her number, and those numbers are quite likely a good number of independents. The same is probably true of Trump. I think he probably drew out a lot of independents who didn't cross, but showed up for a primary that they might not ordinarily have done. But the trouble that I think the troubling question, right, if you're a traditional Republican like me, or if you're Nikki Haley, is one more point. I think there's maybe a little bit of a weird thing of comparing this primary to an open Republican primary, right? In some ways, this is almost closer to someone running against an incumbent president in a primary. Not exactly the same. But I think the better comparison would be George Bush and Pat Buchanan, right, in 92, as opposed to, say, John McCain and George W. Bush, right? So I think that there is that sort of presumptiveness about Trump, and presumptuousness about Trump. he is sort of, you know, in essence, kind of the incumbent. And when you're looking at primary numbers, that's, you know, if you look at how did they do against an incumbent? Well, if you had someone launching a challenge and getting 40% against a sitting incumbent president, that would be huge, or huge, as they say in Queens. But I think you can all look at that and say, wow, that's really good news for Nikki Haley. The dark question that I think they have to be asking themselves in the campaign, and a lot of America would be asking themselves, is if Nikki Haley can't win in New Hampshire, in the New Hampshire primary, what primary can she win? And I don't know that there is one.
Well, I mean, I think that brings up an excellent question as you head to South Carolina, which is her home state, right, where she's been governor. And obviously, that doesn't look phenomenal in either polling or in endorsements right now, which
I'd say it's a lot less than phenomenal. I mean, it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible.
I mean, it looks worse than New Hampshire.
Oh, definitely for the distance out that we are at the same time as we were looking, for sure. And that is in context of course, the thing we haven't mentioned, which was right last, you know, on Sunday, DeSantis ends his campaign and does, I think, what everybody assumed he was going to do, and that was throw his support behind Trump. And you know, even though he's going to take a few more shots at Trump, he's also going to take some shots at Nikki Haley, but he's ultimately going to support Nikki Haley. I mean, he says, look, it's clear to me that a majority of Republican Trump. Primary voters want Donald Trump another chance. And while I've had disagreements with Donald Trump, Trump is superior. Right. I mean, and so that's what we go out on. So it's tough. So, I mean, do you hold any hope for Haley in South Carolina?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I feel you.
None whatsoever. I'm looking at this as the, you know, cold hard analyst type person. I mean, if it was a rooting interest, I would say absolutely. Go Nikki Haley. I think it would be fantastic to have Republicans have the first woman president. Right. That would be a huge blow to the Democrats. But that person is not going to be Nikki Haley, or at least it's not going to be Nikki Haley in 2024.
It's going to be Kamala Harris.
Well, that's, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. But I think that's those are just the way the numbers are adding up. And I could wish and hope otherwise. But that's, again, we are where we are.
Well, let's throw another wrinkle on this, Jay. So, I mean, yesterday, so that's Friday, Donald Trump is found to have violated again the court, and once again been found to have defamed E. G. Carroll. This time, the jury came back with a absolutely sizable penalty, topping, almost getting to, you know, $90 million as a result of what he said he was holding in cash as a way to try to get him to stop talking about her and defaming her. And so, you know, again, does that potentially change? I don't mean just that particular item, but I think one thing that a lot of analysts, and I think more so in the popular opinion, is to say, well, if you get enough of these cases, if you get enough of these hits, then maybe Nikki Haley can do something. In other words, like we said, it's a long time until that primary. You know, what if he continues to violate this order again? He's already on the hook now, like I said, for around $90 million between the two judgments. And I can imagine him going out on the trail and saying something else. Does this offer an opportunity, since there's a long period of time, given that we're kind of seeing some of these court cases bite him?
I don't think so. I think the if anything, every loss he has in court makes him more popular. I think there's one core, you know, core contingent that, as he famously said, I mean, if you could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, that will vote for him no matter what at this point. And there are others who I think just look at, listen, we know who Donald Trump is. He's been in the public eye, public life for, you know, some 40 years now. We knew what we got when we voted in 2016, we saw what we got in 2016. But you know, we still prefer that to Biden. I think that's where it is. I don't think there is a you know, proverbial straw that's going to break this camel's back, that it's like, oh yeah, but the E. Jean Carroll thing, or oh yeah, but the documents, or oh, one more, you know what I mean? One more thing. It's just, at this point, it's almost as if, I think there was a similar phenomenon with Bill Clinton back in the 90s, when all the, as was James Carville's word in the day, bimbo eruptions kept coming, right? To some extent, they almost had there was so many of them. There was like a numbing effect almost, right? You're like, yeah, there he goes again. That's another one. it's almost like you get sort of used to it. And the same thing with, you know, say like Whitewater. Again, oh, geez, it's another Clinton scandal, and it's really complicated. And I don't know. Look, the guy's shady as hell, but the economy is doing pretty well. So I think that's the what I think a lot of people take away. So I don't see a.
Now, I get that on one level, because the way you set that up is the foil of Biden, right? Yeah. And I think that's something we talk about.
Yeah, you're not voting for your favorite candidate. You're only voting for the lesser of two evils.
But here we are in the primary, and I guess, you know, part of me is a little bit surprised that Republicans, fellow Republicans, I mean, I get you're saying, okay, look, I disagreed with him. I mean, I'll be honest, right? This is something I was open on the show about. I voted against Donald Trump. I voted for Biden in the last election. But, you know, here is our opportunity to vote against Trump, but not to vote against Republicanism. So that foil, it only works until you get to the general election. But I still think you're probably right in suggesting that the cases don't hurt him. But I'm not sure if the logic still works the same way when you're talking about either DeSantis now out or Haley.
I think there is a sense among a lot of Republicans for one, there is sort of a one, he is in essence the incumbent. And I think there is something to that. Secondly, I think there's the idea that, and Mike and I talked about this way back in 2016, the sense that the other side is so bad, right? They're so concerned about Joe Biden, as Republicans were so concerned about Hillary Clinton, that if you have to sort of make a deal with the devil, maybe you do, because maybe the devil is what you need here. Right. There is always this sense. This is the most common criticism. If you go out and talk to Republicans, if you're on the campaign stump, why won't you fight? Why won't these people we send there fight for us? Why do they give in on our issues? Because that's what they see, right? Spending keeps going up. There's never, despite all the Republican discussions about, oh, we're going to cut spending, we're going to reform the federal government, we're going to pare back federal agencies and interference and so forth, it never happens, right? Even sort of the heyday, I'm thinking back like the Bob Dole campaign, right? Discussing about, you know, they would reduce the growth rate of certain entitlement programs, and again, Democrats in the media, you know, had the commercial of him, you know, pushing old ladies off the cliff. The government spending never retreats. The size of government doesn't retreat. The border doesn't get better, and Republicans see this and say, look, we keep electing these people, but nothing happens. We want somebody who is going to go in there and you know. As a friend of mine once said, we hired Trump to break stuff.
know, and that's terrible. Almost,
that's the way. Look, this is not working. We actually, hired somebody to.
I mean, I think you're probably right about that. I think that's part of the reason why, in a lot of ways, I mean, it's true. I mean, that's why I got kicked out of Republican things in Florida, and I get that. But again, my fundamental problem with that is that it only makes sense if it's your only option, or you see it as being the only path to victory. And again, the data is pretty clear. You elect Nikki Haley, and we almost guaranteed to bump Biden off. And so the polling seems that way. I mean, listen, she is, at this juncture, is up more against an incumbent than any other person polling the way she does in her own party right now. I mean, it's almost too easy when you look at the appearance.
I very much understand that. I think that if I'm Nikki Haley, I make that my great selling point of my campaign is, look, this shows me beating Biden by a mile. that, you know, no problem. No, nothing close. You know, the other side can cheat. You want to have, you know, people drop, carry the ballots, pick them up and do drop boxes and vote at 3 a.m. in some abandoned gas station, something, whatever. The numbers are such that she would still beat Biden handily. I guess my I have two thoughts on that. One is, and I'm going to ask you as a political scientist, I don't know if those numbers necessarily hold up, right? That's always the hypothetical type number. There's always the like, okay, would you like this candidate, that candidate, or would you like another option, right? And, you know, option C always pulls, you know, through the roof. Well, we want something different. We want something new. When in reality, that's not really what they want. You know, when it comes down to voting, that's not how people vote. So I guess that's my concern. And if I were a Trump voter, I would make that case of one. Look, if you're not voting for Trump, and Nikki Haley will end up, she's not tough enough. She's going to end up getting rolled, just like all these other Republicans have, and you'll just kind of have Biden light. She won't break stuff, right? She won't upset the system that exists. And yeah, there's a again, this is going back to stuff that Republican lore almost, right? And I don't know, maybe Democrats do the same too. But a saying that, you know, we would hear out in the campaign trail doing stuff is about the, you know, why is it that when our guys get elected or get to Washington, they stop being our guys, right? And that's a theme that I think runs, you know, pretty deep through a lot of Republican politics, is that, you know, we elect these people who are going in there and we're going to slash government, we're going to do all this, and then they don't. They get co-opted, or I think the reality is, right, it's just governing is actually harder than campaigning.
Well, I'm glad you said that, right? And that means as a political scientist, the answer is A, our system isn't designed so that one party can control the entirety of the system, right? The minority party has all kinds of levers and brakes on the system. And two, of course, in none of contemporary history has there been circumstances in which say the Republicans in this case could have had a majority on any one of these particular items. And I think that's part of the problem, is I think there is this thought, if we break the system somehow, and this is what I see, this is what worries me about a segment of Trumpers, if we break the system somehow, as you put it, then we're going to get to rebuild it our way, where there won't be any compromise. And at that point, what you're really talking about, I mean, you are describing effectively the fears of the other side, which is dictatorship.
Yeah, I don't know if I go so far as dictatorship. I think the concern that if I'm a Trump voter, here's what I see is, so back in 2012, whatever it was, there was this Republican wave of people who were going to bring in. Was it 2012? No.
Are you thinking six?
I'm probably thinking of the six.
I was thinking. I figured you meant 2016.
Yeah, it was the repeal of Obamacare, right?
Yeah.
That was the mantra. That was what so many Republicans campaigned on. This is, we're promised. This is day one. This is our top priority. And you can debate the wisdom of it one way or the other, but
it was a stupid promise. I mean, that was the, yeah, I mean, that was the underlying problem.
Then,
yeah.
Then they didn't do it, couldn't do it. And everybody's like, well, you know, what was this all about? There's a little bit of sort of in like the Tea Party movement too. Not that I don't want to fault those guys, because I do think they tried, but we're going to roll back spending. We're going to slash this. We're going to slash the deficit. We're going to, so people go there, and then it comes time for the vote, and you just don't have enough numbers, because you have enough Republicans who decide they're not going to do that. Now, they may have good reasons that they say, no, I think this really is a priority, and here really is the spending, and, you know, or maybe you actually you get to Washington and you see what the numbers actually look like, and you realize, oh, okay, well, we still have to do that. And there's political pressures and people being co-opted. And
but let's be honest. I mean,
maybe co-opted is a bad word.
But that fails in part because part of that groundswell shift as you move from the Tea Party to Trump is the idea that you I mean Trump is explicit. We can't touch entitlement items.
Yeah, you know, right?
You can't change that. And you can't touch military stuff. I agree with you.
But Trump is clearly not in that fiscal conservatism.
Yeah. So we get to this point. I mean, so again, if that's what you want. That doesn't make sense. But
well, I would say substitute the border for the fiscal control stuff. Right?
Yeah, well, that could be.
Yeah, that it's not a matter of I was just again using those as examples.
I was just thinking back to George W. Bush, the last Republican president to really take, I think, an honest stab at rethinking about Social Security, for example.
Yeah, and that blew up miserably. Yeah.
Well, I think we should probably pause that for a second, because I think one of the things we should say, right, so if listeners, if you keep in mind for our bonus show this week, one of the things that Jay and I are going to do is we're going to get deeper into the Republican weeds a little bit and offer some prognostications for what we see is happening, how we kind of fit in it, a little bit different of a take. So again, if you kind of like that conversation, we'd love for you to join us as we get to there. But I want to start to pivot a little bit, Jay, and move to Texas, right? Just to my southern state, to the south, you know, because some people think of us as the good Texas here in Oklahoma. I don't
know. I didn't mean that. Okay.
Well, no, I mean, basically, Texas see us as being evil. If anybody ever wants to see, and this is true, watch a little bit of the old King of the Hill and how they talk about Oklahoma. If you want to know what Texans really think about Oklahoma. But let's get into this. So we had kind of a, I'm not often surprised, but I was a little bit surprised over what happened this past Wednesday. So let me set up what happens. We have had a conflict between Governor Abbott and President Biden for some time now. And here's what happened. At the beginning of the year, the U.S. Justice Department filed a motion with the Supreme Court to allow officials to remove razor wire, or at least cut it, to help migrants who might otherwise be killed. It also made hard, as the Solicitor General argued, to have the border control agents with the power and duty to control the border if they're not the ones in control of these border materials, i.e., again, those razor wires. And the primary location in question is Eagle Pass, Texas. And it has faced a record of migrants crossing the border, and it has led to many deaths of those trying to cross the border, most recently as they encountered both waters and a razor wire. And the argument from Abbott is that the border has not had a deterrent effect. And that is if we don't lock it down, if we don't make people, I mean, he's not quite saying this, but I think this is what he's implying. I think he would say it if he could. Look, if people aren't dying to get into the country, then they won't stop trying to get into the country, right? So the border increasings are going to increase unless we make it so deadly that they can't. Now, this week, the Supreme Court then, in an unsigned order, lifted a federal appellate court ruling forbidding agents from removing or changing those structures. Four justices dissented from that order. Not a big surprise who they were: Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. The Court of Appeals had found that the agents were not carrying out their duties by cutting those fence. Although there is no content to the Supreme Court clearly at least disagreed. This is what led to the biggest news of this week, which is Abbott issuing something I would call it a bit like a nullification doctrine redone, an order arguing that President Biden had broken the compact of the federal government and states. He actually released this statement generally and on X, and it says, quote, President Biden has refused to enforce those laws and has even violated them, end quote. He then argued that, quote, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and the other visionaries who wrote the U.S. Constitution foresaw that the states should not be left to the mercy of a lawless president. Now, although I think he might need to reread Hamilton and, by the way, some Madison, too, he then goes on to cite Article 4 and Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, arguing that there is an imminent invasion, and therefore Texas can operate without regard to federal law, or it seems in this case, although he didn't explicitly say it in the order, the Supreme Court. So what really is all of this? What is this? What are these sections? Well, Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution states, quote, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect them each of them against invasion," end quote. And Abbott is arguing that this requirement has been violated. And then if we turn to Article 1, Section 10, which is a limitation of state power in general, it says at the end of that section, quote, "No state shall, without the consent of Congress, law, any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in times of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war," and here's the phrase, "unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit delay," end quote. And this is, it was kind of interesting because this, you know, this is, Ken and I have went through the Constitution last year. So if, you know, for those of you who are interested about this, if you become a supporter, you can kind of listen to our takes on this long before this was going on. But anyway, back to the order. It also cites Arizona v. United States, but pause, not what you're thinking, not the majority opinion. Instead, it cites a dissenting opinion on the issue, which argued that state law could supersede federal law on immigration that had been written by Scalia. Now, Jay, this is there's a lot of things going on here. The first thing that comes to mind, A, is Madison actually wrote about this very issue, and he argued explicitly, and this is in terms of the Alien Acts that gets passed during the administration. Yeah, he basically says, look, unless you have armed troops coming across a border, I'm paraphrasing here, it's not an invasion. And Hamilton, let's go a little bit further, he had even left, he took an even more stringent view on this case. And again, I'm not a lawyer. I'll let you turn you over to you. But I love Scalia, but you don't generally cite the minority opinion when you're issuing law. I was a little taken aback. So what's your take on this? Because I'll be honest, again, I don't get shocked often. I'm not shocked often by Abbott. But this just seemed so, over the top wrong. What do you
think? No, so I look as a if I'm reading the Constitution as an originalist, first as a textualist, and then secondly with an originalist sort of gloss, right? I read that to mean, because the phrasing says shall not make war, right? Except if invaded, to me that does imply invasion by an army, an armed force,
and by another political unit.
Yeah. Well, I think you could make the argument that you could have whatever. Say, let's say it's drug cartels or armed drug cartels, or it was Santa Ana's raiders or something. I wouldn't go so far to say it has to be a recognized another state. But I think it implies that it is an armed invasion, and an invasion also tends to mean if you take it in its originalist context, the idea not just of an incursion, but of a moving into territory with plans to keep it, right? I don't think Governor Abbott declaring this is an invasion, where again, I think metaphorically, right, politically, rhetorically, I think he's entirely correct when you have this many people coming uninvited.
It's not an invasion
in terms of an invading army, which might trigger.
But I want to push back a little bit because I am not on the majority position here with the Republican Party whatsoever. And heck, I'm probably too far to the left, even compared to Mike, because the three of us have done shows on this before. But I really have gotten tired of that rhetoric, because in part, put aside the particularistics of the policy. What we're talking about is individuals fleeing, and whether we think they ought to be playing, ought to be ending up here or not, I don't think there is anything either useful or accurate or descriptive about calling the invasion, because that sets up, I think, this kind of, it normalizes language of viewing these people in a light that that even if you disagree with the policy, is deeply kind of offensive at best.
So I push back, and I disagree. I know Mike feels strongly about this. But if you have at this point 10,000 people a day coming uninvited, coming illegally, and Mike and I had a back and forth about this, and you know, his position, well, they're not illegal if they're coming here seeking asylum. I would say no, that you're still entering the country illegally. You just maybe you might have an affirmative defense to that if your asylum is awarded, which in almost all cases it's not. I would say are all these people fleeing? No, I'm not sure that's the case either. There are a lot of people who are just trafficking fentanyl. And even if they are,
that is again, we're talking like you're right. There's lots of people pushing the border, and I have not done the recent math on this, but to suggest of the 2,000 some people coming across the border that I would put money on the fact that less than 2.5% of them have any interaction with fentanyl whatsoever.
Okay. Fair enough. But I think you can agree, and you could look at the numbers at this. Almost all the fentanyl in this country comes through the Mexican border. I mean, that's pretty well documented. And if you say, okay, it's only 2.5%. So, okay, if 10,000 people are crossing every day, well, so you got 200 people a day carrying fentanyl across the border a day. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm not holding you to your 2%, but
no, I mean, I think that's fair.
Very good reasons why countries have borders. One is to see who's. I mean, we have people who are crossing who are we find them, catch them, are on the terrorist watch list. There are people who have committed numerous heinous crimes once they get here. And
at a lower rate than just the general population, of course.
Right, but understand. No. But those are additional crimes. It's not a question of the crimes that Americans won't commit or something.
No. What I'm saying though is, by that same logic, I guess what I'm suggesting is if you're saying, look, we need to crack down on them because they're somehow particularistically dangerous.
No.
But they're not. All right, that's what I'm suggesting.
I'm saying if you have. I'm saying if there are people who are dangerous at all, and shouldn't be here in the first place, we got enough dangerous people here already, right? You follow me again? Let's say 1% of the people coming across the border are dangerous.
Well, let me ask you a question then. This is an interesting one, right? Because so what? What then would be, so let's put aside the particulars of the policies and just say, if the result needs to be that 0% of the people who immigrate in any way, right, if 0% of the people immigrate could even potentially ever commit a crime, I mean, wouldn't the only number that would make sense for immigration be zero?
No. I'm not saying potentially commit a crime. I'm saying people we know who have committed crimes, right?
Right, but I'm saying is,
why would you import criminals?
So, okay, continue.
Your position is that, well, because anyone could potentially commit a crime, then the only response is immigration is zero.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that enforcement mechanisms. One of the arguments you're making is that we ought to be particularly concerned about the population crossing because of crime. And what I was trying to get at was to ask then, what is the amount of risk at which point we should take lots of money and potentially lots of, you know, razor wire, whatever you want to do to prevent that number, right? So where, what would be an appropriate, because that's the only way you can kind of then make that that policy then, right? So if the answer is, look, right, the fentanyl needs to be at a percent, you know, we got to make sure we're cracking that down. The violent crime has to be at a certain percent. What is that though, right? I mean, it has to be something. So, right?
I'm suggesting if someone comes to the border, they say hi. One, they stop when they get there, right? And say, I'd like to come into this country, and we would say, okay, what are you coming for? And they say, well, I'm fleeing tyranny or whatever. You would go through a process and say, okay, what's your name? Where are you from? You do a background check. Here's the thing. If I cross the border to Canada, they stop me. They check my license. They, you know, check my credentials. They make sure I don't look suspicious. They look, you know, am I carrying anything in my car? Am I bringing anything back? Do I have any of these things? That, you know, XYZ, they go through the list. What's your purpose? How long you staying? When you leaving? Where you going? That's all pretty reasonable. In this case, if you have someone who just wades across the river, you can, one, assume they're not going to go through them. They don't want to go through the normal processes for some reason or another.
Okay, but I see. I grant that. What I was asking though is that in the context of this, we're suggesting, okay, what's the likelihood that I ought to put up things that might kill individuals who are doing that, and for the particular benefit of keeping down what? So what we want to get here, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but right in the context of what Abbott is doing, we are putting up deadly things. And what we're suggesting is that the level, again, people, I don't disagree that you have people violating the law. What I'm suggesting though is how violent do we want to be in the upholding of that law, and what is the net benefit to both the cost of upholding it at the rate that we're doing, and cost in terms of not just money and manpower, but we're talking in cost of individuals' lives, right? So for example, you know, if somebody is stealing some gum, right, that's wrong and I don't want that to happen. But I don't want the likelihood of the guy who steals gum to be that he gets killed as a result of, right, enforcing, yeah, the law.
Yeah, you're making the argument. There's a case that everybody studies in law school, and I forget the name of it now, but has to do with, there's a guy who's got this shed, and he's got, I forget what he's got in the shed, some kind of collectible cans or something dumb, right? But it's very important to him. So like he's got this shed, and he booby traps the shed with a shotgun, so that if anybody tries to steal his cans, they get blown away.
Wow.
And they do. And the courts say, well, come on. That's not sporting. You know, clearly the interest in life exceeds any interest you have in protecting your property. You've got a right to protect your property, but you can't protect it at the point of this. So I think that's the argument I hear. And I think it's not a, I think that's a good one. I think the response to that is state and national borders are different, would be one response. I'm not saying I agree with that response, but I'm saying there are many places in the world where if you just go running across their border without identifying yourself, they may shoot you, right? And I'm not suggesting that's the way we ought to be. I'm saying I think if you're looking at you know, what right does a state have a right to keep people out by violence? I think they do.
Now, when you say the state here, I think this is one where, you know, the colloquial conversation.
Well, the state.
Do you mean the United States? Okay, okay,
yeah,
okay.
Saying, yeah,
because we're, you know, we're, yeah, talking about nation, Texas too.
Nation, yeah. Right.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I should have clarified when I said that. I meant that by a sovereign nation state. I think has an inherent right to protect its own borders with violence if necessary. Does that mean they always ought to? No. But I'm saying I think most people would say that principle adheres, right? So the next question is the razor wire going too far to serve the ends of what? Preventing crime, preventing drug trafficking, preventing just the general societal problems that you're getting with this massive influx. Again, I think there's a good argument to be made there that it is overbroad. The other side would be, look, if you put up a sign saying danger, do not cross, razor wire, you may die. I think that, you know, that would seem to be not unreasonable. There are plenty of places, private property, right, that would have such signs. And, you know, so I think if that's the idea is to warn people away, say, listen, we're not kidding here. I understand that as well. Now I'm not sure, and I'm not sure what's the best way if you have a water barrier, right? What's the best way to protect that? But it gets to be just a weird sort of if the federal government had a replacement policy, right? That okay, we're going to take out the razor wire, but we're going to do this instead. That will still serve that interest, but will be less likely to injure someone or kill someone. That'd be one thing. But instead, the federal government's position has been, we're not going to do anything.
Well, so let's get back to then the central question here, which is, right, the fundamental disagreement between Biden and Abbott. Abbott is saying, look, Biden, I disagree with what you've done, right? So it's not that Biden hasn't done anything. I mean, as a matter of fact, he's been getting criticized on the left for his right. policies.
What has he done to stem illegal border crossings? I mean, he got rid of Marine in Mexico on day one. He's
well,
granting parole
in part for number one, of course, because that was a violation of our international obligations. So, I mean, that was just putting us back in line with law. Now, I mean, well, you could make the argument that
we have an international obligation to accept people across a border that we don't.
our treaty obligations are such, yes, that if you have a reason to be expect that you have. Asylum seekers who are fleeing, you actually cannot force them to wait. They are supposed to do that in the country of origin. Yeah, I mean that is.
That's my point. In the country of origin or another country, they're supposed to.
No, the country in which you're looking for your asylum. You don't have to wait. Make the asylum. That is the underlying argument of international human rights is that you don't have to remain in danger as you're making that claim, but. One of the things that I think does point to that, of course, is we've had more stops at the border. That's one of the ones that's always weird. I mean, maybe you can enlighten me on this one, right? So we have had more stops on the border and as a percentage, more individuals caught by agents than any other point. How is that not at least attempting to enforce the border?
Because they're caught and then they're released. That's why. I mean, it's one thing if you were, say, caught and turned back, caught and deported, caught and taken, or caught and said, listen, you can't come into this country until you've received asylum, or unless you can show a compelling case that you actually should receive asylum. And the problem is, you know, and you would be right in arguing this, once you're on American soil, then you do have, then you've got that asylum right. So the only... Under our system as it's set up now, the only way to do this is to prevent someone from crossing. Otherwise, anyone can come, request asylum, and they're here for several years. Maybe they show up for the hearing, maybe they don't. And then you get to the big question of where we're going to be in a couple years. Let's say the Biden administration spends tons and tons and tons of money, hires all sorts of administrative law judges. We set up immigration courts on every corner. We get all these hearings done, and asylum is denied, as it typically is, for about 90%. What do you do? Right?
I thought that was hypothetical. I thought you were going to answer question. I mean, I'm sorry.
It's rhetorical, right? But what then?
Well, I mean, again,
would our country be in the position to deport 9,000 people a day?
Well,
assuming they're coming in 10,000 a day, assuming 10% get asylum.
I mean, my response obviously is not going to be the typical response. So I'm not good here. My answer is I wouldn't want to do any of that. I would see all of that as being an absolute waste of time. As a matter of fact, one of the things I've pointed at to before, and I would look at it again, one of the things that Americans just absolutely saw as being overriding oppression in the early 19th century was this idea that you're going to have to produce papers as you came to the border, and you're going to do this kind of stuff because, you know, free people get to move between free states. And that was an argument between France and the United States. What was a huge argument was France is going to make us, report, what Americans are doing as they're coming into France. We were outraged about that. We've lost that. I mean, and today we have much harder borders, but that comes as a result of World War I, World War II. And I get that. And we see these threats as being more imminent and that they can hurt things. But I disagree with that position. And I think that, again, this is not a popular position, and I absolutely get that. And it's not one that's going to win many elections, and I get that. But I will stand on people's moral right to be able to move. The idea that nation state should have a lockdown on me because I've been born in a particular location has no standing. But we want to have these very deeply difficult systems in which for people to move. I'll pause there on my soapbox for a minute.
Yeah, it's one thing to say, and I would agree with you there. A state does not have a monopoly on keeping its people from moving somewhere, right? It's not East Germany, not North Korea, not the old Soviet Union. We're saying you can't emigrate. I think the position is you can emigrate if someone will take you, right? But that's different than saying.
If you're a free country, if you want to be a free country, part of what makes free, I think, is to say you can come here, right? We're not going to restrict those things under
certain rules and regulations. Because if you say anyone can come here anytime, anywhere, then I think maybe you got the free, but you lose the country. I mean, you're not a nation state if you don't have a border.
I see. This is where I disagree. I think that is part of what makes the United States possibly an early one of the great countries of the world. And I think that's one of the reasons there was so much early heartburn and consternation over the Alien Acts. In our second presidential administration. But again, I recognize that is not a position that's going to win me any goes, because we do want to draw these lines. But now I want to bring us back, because we've gone on deeply into the philosophy of it. What do you think about the Abbott order specifically? He is suggesting, look, I am not going to listen to the Supreme Court, and I am declaring that the federal government does not apply in this position. And it could be coming to an head, because right now we have both sides calling for either perhaps the federalization of the Texas National Guard if Abbott uses them to defy the Supreme Court. And on the other side, we have Representative Chip Roy arguing that Abbott ought to go ahead and ignore the Supreme Court and make sure that he remains in control of all National Guard to uphold his order. As he put it, he's like, look, if somebody's breaking into your house, you don't listen to the court. You tell the court to go to hell, and you defend yourself, and then you figure it out later, end quote. So let's bring it back to that and what you think on that front.
So I don't think it's going to come to that. Actually, I think what Abbott's doing is more rhetorical than anything else. But I think he's doing it to highlight what is a really significant problem, particularly for Texas. So I don't think that in the end Abbott will, I don't know what he secede or whatever you want to call it.
Well, Texit is what they're calling it, actually. There's a movement, the Texit movement.
Yeah, I get it. But it's not going to happen.
I don't disagree.
You know, and I think this is the left sometimes plays these things up of anytime we say, hey, I don't think Biden's doing his job and the states need to step in. It's a civil war. So no, I think Texas could be resolute in enforcing its own laws, and then to the extent it's allowed to enforce federal laws doing so. So no, I don't think that's going to all blow up. I do want to push a little bit though on the other general immigration question.
Okay.
And I've mentioned this to Mike a number of times. There's a little Thai restaurant I go to for lunch a lot of times, and I've gotten to know the owner, super nice guy, and we talk, and he's always carrying on about how much he hates Joe Biden. And the reason, one of the reasons, I mean, he said, listen, I had to go through so much to get to this country, and I did it legally. I followed the rules. I did all this stuff. I had the job lined up and the money, and I got the right visas, and I had to wait, but I got, and here I am, and I've done this, and I've built this business, and I'm employing people. I'm serving delicious Thai food, and I tried to get my wife over here. It took me 10 years. To get her through. Now that's ridiculous just in terms of the system. But here's a guy who's saying, I followed the rules. And none of these other people have to. And I'm a bad guy for suggesting that they ought to follow the rules. And Trey, my grandfather was an immigrant. Great grandfather, actually, and then sent for the rest of the family. And what he did was he lined up work. He had a place to go, and you had to tell the government, we're going, here's where I'm going. I can support myself. He went through Ellis Island. You know, everyone knew who he was and checked out. You're not a criminal. No. Sent for the family. You got a place to go. Yeah, you have a means of support when you get here. Yeah, we do. And that's the way it worked for thousands and thousands of immigrants from the, you know, the that system probably starting in the 1850s on. And I think that's the concern. I'm very much not anti-immigration. I'm very pro-immigration. But I'm pro-lawful immigration.
So to your point, I mean, I do feel for the Thai, for your Thai friend, and I do feel for the individual. I mean, that is part of the problem. The legal system itself is absolutely terrible. And even if you don't want to go all the way you want to with me, I think what this points out is how terrible the legal system is, right? The barriers that we have put into it are right. Such that it is so, so as you noted, like, why does it take him 10 years to get his wife here? And that also, of course, empirically explains why so many individuals wouldn't want to do it. They might not have the means or the money. It's expensive to do our system. I feel for the Thai guy. I'm not quite done because I'll go one step further and I'll say, and as a result, this is why, and I think Democrats don't always recognize it. This is why those individuals who jumped all through those hoops tend to be on the Republican side. But what I would suggest is it's very similar to the old, I had to do it. You ought to too. Is this really the best way to do this? Probably not. But I had to do it, so you ought to have to do it too. And I understand the justification he has for saying, like, look, make that difficult. And that is why in Texas, you have that. I agree.
He would not say, and I think most immigrants would not say, I want the same difficulties imposed on me. Or imposed on others that were imposed on me.
I am mimicking some of my former students who work, who take that view. So maybe I wasn't trying to put that on him, but yeah, Mexican immigrants have made that kind of argument. But continue, you were trying to get to something else there.
Not saying, listen, I had to, you know, it took me this many years, it should take them this many years. I think they would someone would be very happy to say, we should reform the process so it doesn't take that long, so it's not that burdensome. But there needs to be a process. It can't be just, I'm going to jump ahead of everyone else or ignore the process.
But I think just let's make it an easy, cheap, free process. But again, I get it. No, that's not popular.
Everything. Well, it's not popular, but it's also then, you know, it's an expense to weed out the folks who are bringing the fentanyl or might be violent criminals. And I think that's an expense that, you know, the government ought to.
But see, one last thing on that. Like, I hear that. But OK, let's go back to one of our biggest, most violent moments in American history, 9/11, carried out by individuals who went through the stupid process. So I guess I'm also a little bit biased by the fact that even our current very hard process failed. And so I sit here saying, okay, so if we do a complicated process to somehow keep it all out, I don't think we're going to keep it all out anyway. And it's so I don't see what I'm netting. So I guess as I continue to go along, I just keep saying, well, look, we can continue to have some kind of process that, if it's anything like what we do right now, has failed in epic and spectacular ways when it was working theoretically. And so why do I want to spend even more time on that? Why not just make it even easier?
I'm not even sure how to respond to that. What do you think the response of you acknowledge there are many people in this world who would want to do our country harm?
Of course.
Who wants to kill Americans just for the sake of killing Americans?
Of course. And there, yes. But I mean, again, the system as we have it right now has not consistently stopped that from happening.
Right.
So
you would, this is sort of the as the phrase goes, letting the perfect become the enemy of the good. Since we can't stop all the terrorists, we shouldn't do anything. I mean,
no,
I think
it's kind of like saying, hey, look, putting, let's imagine I've got this, you know, we've had carjackings going on, and I have to now, in order to get my car into OC's parking lot, I have to go through 14 different steps. It takes forever. It's kind of maybe even a little bit dangerous in some ways. And I'm doing it so that, you know, I'm not going to have to suffer a significant number of carjackings. But if I'm still experiencing a significant number of carjackings, now all I have is both the significant number of carjackings and all of those additional processes on me to get my car into the parking lot. So what I'm suggesting is to say is that if the effective rates, if the goal of a particular policy is to just change the probabilities in a statistically significant way, and empirically it doesn't appear that it's changing it, right? So if the carjackings are still within a magnitude of order of the same, what am I gaining by now having the additional sets of difficult processes to get my car into the go? So I'm not suggesting it would have to be at zero. I'm just suggesting that empirically that we have not experienced additional quantifiable safety as a result of the kinds of policies as they exist right now. So if the goal is to bring those down, and the demonstrable evidence appears to be that it does not, I now both get the negative policy outcomes I'm supposed to be protecting from. Yeah.
No, I get it. Yeah, it's a longer line at the airport, and you got to take.
And I'm no safer.
And all that kind of stuff. I think that's not a bad argument. But going to the immigration question, let me maybe just put it this way, as succinctly as I can. What steps do you think should be required for someone to gain admission to the country?
Well, I would want to look at the data and see, are there any things that I could ask or do that would empirically offer me a higher level of safety while simultaneously not countervening my ideal of people freedom, right?
Right.
But I would have to actually take a look at those items and say, well, what are those? Are there ones? And what could we actually, honestly, I am not sure what it would be.
Would you require foreign nationals to enter through certain places?
If that netted me something. Otherwise, why would I care?
Okay.
All right. So again, if it prevented something, if it helped us on some actual policy outcome, in a meaningful way, then I'd be open to having a conversation about it. But it doesn't appear that it has.
I'd like to know who's in my country.
This goes back to a little bit of a difference. I don't care, right? Like, one of the things that kind of fundamentally bothers me is the fact that we think that we have to know specifically every single human being, like, who are you? What are you doing? Okay, I don't care. I mean, as long as you're not harming me, harming other people, what do I care?
Yeah. But the argument would be made that perhaps if we had been more stringent in caring about who's coming into our country and why, we could have screened out the 9/11 terrorists.
So in other words, if we were even more stringent than we had been in our, because they went legally.
They have student visas, but keep in mind, there are a lot of folks then who overstayed student visas.
So, I mean,
if we'd been more quick to enforce that, and so many, what used to be, I think it's less so now because of the people coming across the border, but that was the biggest number were people overstaying student visas.
If
that had been more enforced, could we have stopped 9/11 or maybe at least? And I think we can argue that there have been a lot of terrorist acts that have been prevented because we stopped people. But it's, prevention stuff to measure.
Well, it isn't as hard to measure as it could be. We make it more difficult in part because of the way we release data in the state is opaque. It's difficult to answer that goes back to a lot of policies of having secrecy as results to those things. And that data isn't generally available to scholars. And so we can't always answer that question. So, that it is true that it can be harder to measure prevention, but it's not impossible. In this particular case, it is much more difficult to answer the question because, of course, we don't release really good data, which is another problematic aspect. But I mean, now we start to get into the question about, I think we ought to release more data too, so that we can answer those questions without the opacity to have better policy outcomes. But that, I think, brings us to I know we're running a little bit long, Jay. But I think we need to get at least one last item from the week.
Please. I'm sorry.
It's all good. It's still border, right? So we can still sit there.
The border, yes.
But this week, of course, we appeared to have bipartisan support for an immigration bill that would be paired with financial dollars to the Ukraine and Israel. And there seemed to be some movement on that. And again, I mean, obviously, this might be something that you're more excited about than I would have been in some ways. But these talks really seem to falter when this Wednesday, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell suggested that the politics had shifted. Why? Because President Trump wants to build his reelection campaign around immigration. And to kind of not step on the toes there, we don't want to make a fix and therefore stop him from running on that. And so this came out according to Punchbowl News. And then really kind of tellingly, McConnell and his team would not walk back or dispute those comments, which makes it likely that he probably said something in those vicinities. As a matter of fact, though, driving forces for this bipartisan bill is my own senator here from Oklahoma. Full disclosure, I know his campaign staff and they come here and visit OC. I don't work for him or do anything like that, but, he does have a relationship here with OC and likes to come out here. He is one of the ones kind of pushing on that. He's argued that the deal is not dead and that they shouldn't really just focus primarily on Trump, arguing that McConnell was just, quote unquote, acknowledging political realities, end quote, not abandoning the deal. Yet Trump quickly argued very forcefully on Truth Social that, quote, I do not think we should do a border deal at all unless we get everything needed to shut down the invasion of millions and millions of people, many from parts unknown, into our once great but soon to be great again country, end quote. So, even as we're talking about this on Saturday, Jay, it appears that there might be some life support for this, but it's still kind of hard to see how it might pass the House as we continue to see people coming out against it. What do you think about? Excuse me. Let me try that again. What do you think about that? And what do you think about trying to have these two things tied together in order to have that bipartisan deal? As a matter of fact, on Friday, Biden said, look, you put this into effect and I will shut us down every time we hit the cap number of that average, I believe, of 3,500.
Yeah. So first, I would say in sort of the punch bowl news getting the scoop here that, you know, wait, you're telling me Trump is going to run on the border?
I mean,
when did this happen? I mean, to me to say, well, geez, the politics have shifted. This is, I mean, obviously, this is what, you know, in some extent, all Trump's been talking about for 6-7 years now. So I don't think you can say, oh, geez, all of a sudden we found out that President Trump's going to be running on border security.
Well, no, the thing would be McConnell saying, look, we've got to kill this because, the primary is over effectively.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not buying that, and I think since when was Mitchell when McConnell ever looking out for Donald Trump? I think is the other piece. But anyway, I think there ought to be a deal. I think there will be a deal. How good of a deal there is, we'll see. I'm not sure exactly how you mentioned this earlier. I was kind of had a late night last night and
yeah.
Saw the headline as far as Biden's proposal. So I can't speak to it with a lot of specificity. My guess is if he comes up with some sort of fig leaf cover, he can, you know, pass it and say he's stopping the border. I'm not sure how that works. Right. I mean, walk me through. And again, if you know, because maybe we just don't know. Right. What the. Well, this would actually
well,
work.
The text of the deal is not available. Yeah, I mean, the text of the deal is not available. So I'm always hesitant until I can actually read some of a bill. I'm not going to make any kind of predictions on that.
So that's you know, again, kind of where I am. So I don't know for sure if Biden says he's going to shut down the border. I think a good question is, well, you know, again, why didn't you do this 3 days and 30,000? Migrants ago. So I don't think he's actually going to shut down the border, but there'll be something, right? And I think Republicans can still run and saying this deal was totally insufficient. It was a sellout. He didn't do it, you know, and so forth. And Trump can certainly run that way, but you can still get something done. And I'm willing to take half a loaf, you know, at a time.
So, the heartburn in the House right now, I think, is primarily over the assistance to Ukraine. And that's where I am not sure if there's going to be the ability to pallet that at the same time as they're also having some major conversations over the budget still. At the same time, that includes some items like the child tax credit changes. It seems unlikely that Republicans in the House from some quarters are going to want to take this up, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, again, I think if you can give Republicans the ability to declare even a partial victory on the border, they'd be willing to go forward with Ukraine funding. That's the question, right? Is whatever this deal is going to give those Republicans enough cover? To say I'm doing something on the border in exchange for Ukraine funding. And I again, like you said, we just don't know yet.
Yeah. Well, Jay, I'm going to pause this there. And you know, we did not get to everything we had intended.
Yeah, we digressed a whole
lot. So we're going to have a huge bonus show. So listeners, we're going to talk more about the Navarro sentencing. We're going to talk about a secret surveillance court. And we're going to do what our kind of predictions about the Republican Party and our view of what's going to be coming of that as we move forward in our bonus show. So I hope you join us for that. Now, if you aren't already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I really hope you'll consider becoming one. I mean, you're going to get these kind of cool things that Jay and I are going to do in just a minute. Or as Ken and I often has been doing, you know, we have been going through the Constitution, gotten into the Bill of Rights. And we would love for you to kind of come. It's a chance for us to get away from just the story. So we're going to do a few stories, but we're going to break away from the news cycle, as we always do, to kind of give you that broader context, especially about conservatism and the Republican Party. So if you want to become a supporter of the Politics Guys, it couldn't be easier. You can just head to patreon.com/politicsguys. And you're going to see all the different levels of support there. And there's all kinds of cool extras you get depending on the level that you're at. So this can mean something like being a part of our very active Discord group. I've been debating with them on there right now. Jay, you've got some deep supporters on Discord. I don't know if you know that or not.
No, they, I don't tend not to go on. It's not that I don't want to, because I do. It's just a matter of, you know, justice is a jealous mistress.
Well, no, I hear that, and but I am thankful I get to be a part of that because of my schedule. I'm busy, but I get to be busy when at different times, and it works out that way. And so, again, you'll get to see all those different tiers, gear, and benefits and level support. If you head to patreon.com/politicsguys, you can support us in other ways. You can support us on Venmo, where we're at, Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. All of those links are available in the show notes. Go ahead and scroll down. Or you can hit us up on the web at politicsguys.com/support. Now, if you'd like to get that midweek show, but you're just not in a position to financially do it, I totally get that. Again, listen, I'm poor. So if you just shoot an email to mail@politicsguys.com, we can get you all set up for that. Now, whether you're a supporter or not, we really would appreciate it if you would send this episode out into the wild. So maybe head to politicsguys.com, share this episode with a friend. You know, maybe you've been having some a post-holiday hangover. You know, you were debating on the right and maybe, you know, immigration came up and you thought that Jay was absolutely right. And or maybe you thought, I don't know, maybe a few of you might have thought I was right. Probably not. But that's OK. Share the show and you can, with your friends, and see what they have to say about those kinds of things. And you can use that on any social media that you choose. If you've got a question, comment, correction, gripe, or anything else you'd like to share with us, don't forget, you can always reach out at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you can guess where you can, I'm sorry, X, and you can find those links all in the show notes. Old habits die hard. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Marino, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode next week. I hope you'll join us then.